Steve Barkley Ponders Out Loud is sponsored by the AAIE Institute for International School Leadership. Preparing educators for the unique challenge of international school leadership through online courses led by international school leaders. Learn more at AAIEinstitute.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Steve Barkley Ponders Out Loud podcast. For over three decades, I've had the opportunity to learn with educators at all levels, both nationally and internationally. I invite you to listen as I explore my thoughts and learning on a variety of topics connected to teaching, learning, and leading with some of the best and brightest educators from around the globe. Thanks for listening in. Teacher Autonomy and Coaching, a conversation with Jim Knight. I'm excited today to have Jim Knight join me on the podcast. Jim and I go way back in working in the area of coaching, and we've had several opportunities to learn with and from each other. So welcome, Jim.
My pleasure to be here, Steve. I have enjoyed now for, I'm thinking, 20, 25 years, our 20, learning partnership.
25 is the number I came up with when I was trying to think about it.
So it's great to have another conversation, and I always try to find ways for us to talk, so I'm grateful for this one.
So, Jim, I just got excited when I read your recent piece in Educational Leadership on Teacher Autonomy. I'll put the link in the lead-in to this podcast, but it was titled Why Teacher Autonomy is Central to Coaching Success. And I'm wondering if you want to start with kind of giving your definition of teacher autonomy, and then is there something recent in your insights that pushed this to an area you wanted to write about?
Well, I would say, first off, that it's actually an article I've been writing probably since we met. You know, I've been looking at what's the nature of the relationship between one professional and another, and what kind of conversation makes the most sense. And I was really influenced by Paulo Freire's work a long, long time ago, and then Peter Block was a big influence, and then other people like Rhian Eisler and others, to think about positioning our conversations as partnerships. And to me, one of the things about coaching is it's not a thing where you just go through the motions and you just have to knock it off and get back to your job. Coaching should be an authentic, a real conversation around getting better. And in many ways, I think coaching is a disruptive activity that changes the nature of conversations around learning. It moves from sort of just going through the motions stuff, where, oh, let's go to the workshop, and if I get one good thing, it's great, to a real genuine focus on what's learning. And to me, it's part of a process of changing the culture of learning in schools. So I feel strongly that if we want the schools our kids deserve, we have to treat teachers as professionals. And a huge part of treating teachers as professionals is to honor their capacity to make decisions for themselves. And so that's, I'd say, that's in essence what it's all about. In terms of defining teacher autonomy, I think it's that there are things you know, it's not to say everything's up for grabs. It can't be a choice to show up at 11 o'clock and teach your classes because you're not a morning person. And you can't be a toxic force on teams. You can't be bullying kids. You can't be choosing not to learn. So there are lots of things that have to happen, and there's going to be school-wide expectations that have to happen. But the bulk of the matter is, when it comes to deciding what happens in the classroom, if we just tell people what to do, I think it's flawed for a whole host of reasons. And I think honoring teacher autonomy is going to get better outcomes, both for well-being for kids and for achievement for kids, too.
So, Jim, I frequently speak to the issue of remembering for coaches that you're coaching a professional. And I describe the difference in that is that if I were looking at a trade, I might teach you the right way to do something and then coach you to do it the right way. But if I'm working with a professional, I'm working with a person who is really in an area where they study a lot, they learn a lot, and then they have to conduct experiments with their clients. So the way an attorney experiments with a case or a doctor experiments with the patient, the teacher's experimenting with learners.
Yeah, I would say a defining characteristic of professionalism is discretion, the ability to make decisions. We go to a a doctor, because we want the doctor to look at all the data she can gather and make a decision about what's best for our health. We don't go to the doctor so she can, you know, plug a little thing into our body and give us a printout. There may be an element of that, but ultimately the professionals make a decision based on their expertise. They have to make a discretionary decision. It's discretion, maybe more than anything else, that defines what a professional is. So if we take away the person's ability to make discretion, that is, to make decisions in the moment about the complexity they're facing, we treat them like they're unskilled laborers, not like they're professionals.
And with that then comes the loss of responsibility and accountability for the outcome.
Right. If I'm just doing what I'm told and it doesn't work out, it's not my fault. I just did what I'm told. If you want people to be responsibly accountable, is the term I use in the article, they need to set a goal that they're committed to, and they need to base it on a clear picture of current reality. They need to be learners. It's a deeper level of change when it's responsible accountability.
Talk a little bit about the concept of coaching being goal-driven.
Well, that's just an interesting thing. You should ask that, because I've been thinking a lot about that recently. My friend and colleague, John Campbell, he quoted somebody else, I think, but his phrase is, if there's no goal, it's just a nice conversation. And we've spent an awful lot of time analyzing how coaching works. And if you look at the book, Instructional Coaching, I don't really talk about goals there. Instructional coaching is really about learning how to implement practices. But we really found that unless there's a goal, the teacher's not that motivated, and you don't have an objective standard of excellence. So having a goal, you know, if we say, I want to make sure that all my kids can write a paragraph, and we try to implement a practice, if we implement that teaching practice, let's say it's formative assessment, and we don't do it in a very good way, they're not going to be able to write the paragraph. And so the goal becomes an objective standard for excellence. I don't have to say you're not doing it the right way or the wrong way. The goal does it. And then a student-focused goal is more compelling for a teacher because they want their kids to succeed. And so when they've got a goal that matters to them, we call it a peers goal, powerful, easy to implement, emotionally compelling, reachable, which is really the smart stuff. We can measure it. We have a teaching strategy to hit it. And then student-focused, not teacher-focused, it's going to work. What we found is when you have a teacher-focused goal, you don't get the same degree of sustainability. That is, they try for a while, then they don't stick with it. But if you have a student-focused goal, I want my kids to feel psychologically safe in school. I'm going to know when I get there, they're more compelled to do it. Now, recently, maybe it's just recently for me, but there have been a lot of publications around the concept of habits. And you'll hear people say, well, I don't focus on goals, I focus on habits. But my thinking is, they're not mutually exclusive terms. In fact, I think there's at least three things going on. One of them is we do need to develop habits. Another one is we need to learn how to do things. And another one is we need goals to shape and direct the work we do. So let's say I wanted to run the Boston Marathon, which right now is quite undeniably humanly impossible. Let's say that was my goal. Well, that goal brings focus to what I do. And then the habit might be that I get up every day and I run for however long I need to run, but I make a habit of running every day. And then the learning part is I read about what's the best kind of food, what kind of shoes should I wear, should I run the whole thing, should I do a run walk where I walk every 10 minutes for 1 minute, how should I lean my body. And so all three of those things come into play. I need a goal to shape what I'm doing, to give me direction. I need to develop habits, routines, so the thing is sustainable. But I also need to learn and integrate stuff into what I do. And same thing with the classroom. There may be some habits you do. Maybe the way you begin the class might be habitual, or the way you respond to conflict in the classroom. The way you correct students is probably habits. But there's going to be learning, and they're going to be. But for coaching, you need a goal because you need a finish line. You need to know what you're striving for, and you also need that external standard of excellence and a commitment. And a goal is going to probably increase commitment on the part of the teacher. So I'm still working that out. I think there are times when you have to learn something. Like when I coach coaches, the first thing we're doing is let's just figure out the impact cycle. Let's just figure out how to do it. And I can see if you're doing gradual release that you're going to learn let's figure out how to do the I do it, we do it, you do it. Let's just get that part figured out. But ultimately, at some point, and to me, the goal is a central part of coaching. And the goal is what really drives you forward. You have to figure some stuff out first, but eventually you're going to have to shift to a goal. Now, one more thing. Christian Van Neuerberg, whom you know and I know, has written about coaching in Arabic cultures, and his coaching in that book, he doesn't talk about goals. He says goals aren't a part of that because the culture isn't really a goal-driven kind of culture, which I thought was kind of fascinating. But nonetheless, that's how I see it. There's goals, learning, and there's habits, and they're all important.
So I'm mixing a new word in with my work with that now, as looking at hypothesis. So in my backwards planning process, the goal means I decide what it is I want as the learner outcome. I think that matches up with what you've just described. Then I form a hypothesis of what the student behavior is that would cause the student to master or reach that outcome. That's my goal. And then I have another hypothesis, which is what's the teacher behavior that's going to get the student behavior for me. And so as I'm working with the coach through that process, I'm identifying what it is I need to get kids to do that's going to cause the learning. And then what are the behaviors I can take on as a teacher that are likely to cause that to happen? And so as I lay the process out, then the coach is helping me first to change my behavior, then to identify whether or not my behavior change is bringing about a behavior change in the student. And then lastly, is that behavior change in student moving the student to the success, which was the goal I started working from? I'm finding that people dealing with the hypothesis term lets them understand that they're getting feedback, not on whether or not they're doing it right, but they're getting feedback on whether or not the hypothesis is at all accurate.
Yeah, I think that places the emphasis in the right place. At least it's where we would place the emphasis now, which is on the change in students. In other words, you could really do a great job of implementing a program, but it could have no impact on kids. And so if you create that hypothesis about what students should do, we would probably just call it a student-focused goal. And then you try things out in an attempt to do it. You're going to have to make some kind of guess at what it is. I think that's pretty similar. It's kind of like the design model of improvement. You know, we're gonna establish a prototype, or for us, it's a process when we study coaching, and we're going to try things out and we're gonna make adaptations. I think what's central to both of our ways of looking at things is the teacher has to be able to make adjustments. It's not locked in and guaranteed. Because we found usually the first thing doesn't work that well. You know, and if you just put all your eggs in that one basket, there's a good chance it's not gonna work if you don't modify it to make it fit. Like maybe you got the wrong practice, or maybe even your identified student hypothesis, as you call it, is the wrong thing. So you need to be able to make adaptations. And I think that's the key thing. You know, if you establish a goal, you need to make adjustments and hit the goal, however you define those terms.
Yeah. What I found that I had to go to was separating what I'm calling student outcome behavior from student production behavior. So the outcome behavior tells me that the students reach the goal. So, you know, I can measure the reading comprehension or the writing clarity or the level of a student's performance on a musical instrument. The production behavior are the things that students do prior to being able to achieve the outcome that are going to get them there. And then the part that I find really critical, and it's almost moved me away from having to talk about differentiation anymore, is that there's always going to be some students for whom either that wasn't the right production behavior, or it wasn't the teacher behavior that got this production behavior. So now I have to be making my modifications because I've set that goal for all kids to get there.
Yeah, I would say that's probably, and honestly, I've just been thinking about this the last couple of days, but I would say that's that distinction between habits and goals. So we have the goal, but I might like your term process better than the habit, because not everything's a habit. And a habit is kind of an outcome you're striving for. But yeah, I think that's a really good distinction.
Jim, you talked about the problem with compliance, and I wondered if you want to respond to that a little bit more.
Okay, well, in the article, I distinguish between commitment and compliance. And I say to get commitment, there has to be an element of choice. So if I can't choose, I'm probably going to get at best compliance. And Heath in their book Switch is probably the nicest accessible summary of this research, but unless I care about the goal, I'm not really going to do it. So we say you have to have an emotionally compelling goal. The goal has to be, it's what you think about when you drive home. You know, when the coach and the teacher set the goal, you want the teacher to go, oh man, if we could deal with that, that'd be great. And when you've got that kind of goal, then what the coach is doing is just helping the teacher hit the goal. There's no, like, I'm trying to talk you into anything. But if the teacher doesn't care about the goal, then it's an annoyance. It interferes with their capacity to teach. They'll say something like, I just, you know, I can't wait to get back to just doing my job. And they're not going to do a very good job. They're going to do the bare minimum. They're going to do what they have to do to not get fired or not get in trouble. So that's compliance versus commitment. Commitment is a goal that really deeply matters to the teacher. And without that commitment on the part of the teacher, and people will use the term buy-in, but I don't think that's the right term. I'm not trying to get buy-in.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to do, and the best example of this is Miller's motivational interviewing book in therapy. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get, unpack what it is that this teacher really wants to work on, and then help her or him hit that goal. And then I'm not trying to talk them into anything. I'm just helping them hit this goal. Now, on the other hand, coaching is a dialogue. So if the teacher says, my goal is that my kids have their shoes tied, this really matters to me, I might say, you know, I'm not sure shoe tie edge is your number one goal here. Here's what I think. But I don't tell the teacher what to do. I position it as a dialogue. We're thinking together. But my job in many ways is to help the teacher hit a powerful goal that they deeply care about. A powerful goal, one that will make a lifelong difference for kids. And because the teacher cares about that goal, kids will benefit. And I'm just helping him or her hit that goal. I'm providing an act of service, really, to help them get there. As opposed to trying to fire them up and get them all excited about my goal. You know,
yeah.
Again, John Campbell says, I'd much rather have a less than perfect goal that's chosen by the teacher than a perfect goal that I forced on the teacher.
Yeah.
And I think that's the deal.
I'm laughing because last year in January, I was in a school and the administrator had me sit in on the PLC meetings during the day. And when I met with him at the end of the day, I asked him how he would feel about the PLCs changing their goals. And he reminded me that it was January and asked me why I would suggest that. And my response was because they don't care at all about the ones that you're asking them to work on now. And, you know, back at the beginning of the year, they knew the quicker they got a goal, the sooner they'd get to go home. So they picked a goal they thought the principal would like, or they picked a goal they thought was easy to measure. But the you couldn't get a commitment because the goal wasn't important enough.
Right.
Jim, what do you think is the important role that the coach plays at the start of this process to get the teacher to identify a goal?
So see, for us, and this is a little different maybe than some other approaches, but for us, the first step is to get a clear picture of current reality.
Uh-huh.
And so for us, video is really important. We don't force video, and video pulls you away from, I shouldn't say it pulls you away, but it doesn't keep the focus entirely on student achievement. But we don't focus entirely on student achievement anyway. But video is important. If you don't do video, you can interview the students. You can look at student work in various ways. You can gather data in the classroom and share the data. But we found, in just our informal experience with our two different studies we did, one was in Beaverton, Oregon, one in Othello, Washington, we found that observations don't work that great because the teacher doesn't have a clear picture of the class. And so when you share the data, they're kind of like, I don't think so. Because they it's not that they're being resistant. They just literally don't see it. So video, maybe even video in combination with student work is a way to get. But without a clear picture of current reality, it's going to be hard to get a goal the person's committed to. Then once we have, they've somehow got a clear picture of current reality, we have sort of four different ways. Then we go through a kind of a solution-focused approach to coaching where we say, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, how close was that class to your ideal? Or if they don't like scale questions, we'll say, you know, the classic solution-focused question, if a miracle happened and this class was exactly what you'd want it to be like, what would be different and how would you know? What would be the first thing you'd see? Something like that. And then once we've got them exploring the difference, then we try to help in partnership moving to, you know, questions like what would be different for the students? How would you know? How would you measure that? Do you want that to be your goal? Would you really care about that goal if you could hit that goal? And then once we've got the goal, then we start to look at options for strategies. And often then the instructional coach has to say, do you mind if I share some ideas I was thinking? Because the instructional coach's job is to know what good teaching looks like and help the teacher learn it. And so that collection of teaching practices could be from any number of sources. There's lots of them out there. We've got one, but it could be Marzano or Hattie. It could be our high impact instruction. It could be Doug Lamoff. Well, Hattie would really give you more a framework, not the specifics. But at any rate, they've been doing some kind of professional learning on teaching probably, and the coach needs to know that and says, well, let's talk about what we might be able to do. Maybe they won't know. And maybe the coach will say, look, I don't know. I don't know how we're going to do what you want to do. It's a great goal. Why don't I go off and do some research? I'll come back and then we'll talk about it.
So, Jim, when the teacher is watching that video at the front end, are they more focused on what the students are doing and then describing what they'd rather the picture looked like or what the desired picture of what the students are doing? Or are they paying more attention to the teacher?
So we've got two forms, and you can download them on instructionalcoaching.com. And one of them is watch yourself, and the other one is watch your students. And so the watch yourself is looking at things like the way you ask questions, how many different students are responding, your ratio of interaction, whether or not you use checks for understanding. And the watch your students is things like the kids look engaged, and there's a whole host of different things. And what we found is when I wrote Focus on Teaching about video, what we found is the teachers need that form or they miss a lot of stuff. And in many ways, what the coach does initially is to go through that form and just those two forms, watch yourself, watch your students. But inevitably what we found, I don't know what your experience has been, Steve, but we found when the teacher sits down, they usually start by talking about changes they want to make. They're like, I really need to change my questioning. I really need to have kids have more activities. I'm doing too much talking. I need more student talk. And then the question we ask is, well, if you change your questioning, what's going to be different for the students? Because we want to go back to that student focus goal. But initially, they're about changes they want to make. But we do give them these forms. We don't say you have to show up and tell me what your numbers are on the Likert scale, but give them the forms as a way to sort of think deeper about the video. And I think you and I talked about this in Learning Forward in St. Louis a long time ago. And what we've found is it's best to watch the video separately, not together. If you watch it together, the conversation's kind of stilted. So we give them the forms. We say, you go watch the video. I'll watch it. We'll get together. And then we walk through the questions we've got. Now, the questioning is, you know better than I do, is always different every time. It's an adaptive conversation, but there's a sense in which the purpose of this conversation is to end up with a powerful student-focused goal that the teacher really cares about.
The key that I've been keeping in my mind as I go into all these conversations from a coaching mode is to refrain from telling the teacher what I'm thinking until I know what the teacher's thinking. So that drives my questioning, because I know I've got to uncover the teacher's thinking. So it doesn't mean I won't tell you what I'm thinking. I won't tell you, maybe even if I disagree with you, I may share with you my disagreement, but I'll go into the conversation knowing your thinking and knowing the thinking that I'm going to share with you runs counter to it. I find as long as I keep that in my head, it keeps me questioning the teacher long enough to understand where they're coming from. And that allows the movement of the process further ahead.
Yeah, I would say we do pretty much the same thing. We might come at it a little differently, but the first thing I would say is the classroom is complex. And so I think to take a humble approach is the logical approach, because there's no guarantees. You know, anybody who's taught for a while knows that you can try stuff, but it's not necessarily going to work. So I feel when I share what I have to say, I can say, look, I don't know if this is going to work, but let me sort of throw out something I've been thinking. And I think you would, if you saw a teacher going down the wrong road and you didn't speak up, you'd do them a disservice. But you can do it in a way that our phrase is to position the teacher as the decision maker. And so we say, well, do you mind if I share some things I'm thinking? What do you think about this? Here's how I see it. And I don't want them to feel like I'm trying to talk them into it. I want them to feel like we're exploring this together mutually. And then, we can leave it open. And it's just like two people trying to figure something out as opposed to, oh, I figured out what, you know, once you move into advice, it stops being a dialogue. Yep. And then I want them to agree with me because I've got it all figured out. That's the cool thing about doing model lessons is when you do the model lesson, you go, oh, now I know what this teacher is talking about. The class looks a lot different in front of the class teaching than it does sitting on the outside watching it.
It's interesting. You and I both responded to the same comment on Twitter last week about reflection and feedback. And that whole process has just got me convinced that feedback that the teacher is not the best case scenario is the teacher's requested the feedback because of the goal they've set in the scenario we're developing. But at a minimal, the teacher sees that the whole purpose of the feedback is tied to their reflection. And so the ability of the coach to get that whole reflection process started, I think is most critical.
Best thing I've read about that is Marcus Buckingham and Ashley Goodall's book, 9 Lies About Work, where they essentially hold feedback out to dry. And they say that we think our feedback is better than it is, but we're not usually getting reliable data in the classroom. People, when you say to them, do you mind if I give you some feedback? They kind of go into survival mode and it doesn't help them grow. And then you combine that with the cognitive coaching approach to dialogue. That's how we would do it. We said, rather than me telling you what I think you did right and what I think you did wrong, why don't I share my ideas, you share your ideas, and we'll engage in a dialogue. And usually it's built around some third point, like we want to focus on student achievement or student engagement or exit tickets that show kids feel safe in school or they have hope. And so then people will say, well, what about Hattie's research that shows feedback has a 0.75 effect size? Now, I haven't gone back and read all those studies that Hattie looked at with the meta-analysis, but that's a different kind of thing. Like if someone is teaching me how to pronounce my Spanish correctly, then I want feedback, but that's because that's a technical thing. So it's one thing to teach me how to write a complete sentence. It's another thing to teach me how I should be moved by poetry. And so when you've got something where the outcomes are black and white or technical, is the terminology I use, then feedback makes a whole lot of sense. When I was coaching hockey, I would show the kids exactly how to skate backwards. I'd show it to them. I'd model it for them. I'd have them practice. I'd tell them, this is what you did right. This is what you did wrong. But if I was coaching another coach on how to motivate students, I wouldn't say, here are the 5 things you need to do. Let's break it down. Yeah. And so the complexity is where it becomes different when it comes to feedback.
You just hit the word. If the exciting part of teaching is the complexity of it, and then the exciting part of coaching teaching is that it's almost like you're multiplying the complexity of teaching when you step into that coach's role.
Yeah. So what I did is last year, I wrote this article on the zero learning zone. And the sort of the main idea of the article is we are better people and we have more fulfilling lives when we're learning, but we do all these things to block our capacity to learn. And so I'd say what goes along with the autonomy article is what we're trying to do is we're trying to create the environment and reignite people's desire to learn because they'll be more fulfilled as educators and they'll have a bigger impact on kids' lives. And so what we're really trying to do is foster learning at the professional level and at the individual level. But if I tell you, here's how you need to do it, and I figured it out, and you need to do it exactly the way I say, it's probably not going to foster that level of learning, and it's probably not going to work because it's just too complex to think one size fits all. As Eric Dewey said, it's one size fits one when it comes to teaching. Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you so much, and I look forward to the next time we connect on one of these.
Me too.
Take care.
All right.
Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep, bye-bye.
Thanks again for listening. You can subscribe to Steve Barkley Ponders Out Loud on iTunes and Podbean. And please remember to rate and review us on iTunes. I also want to hear what you're pondering. You can find me on Twitter at Steve Barkley, or send me your questions and find my videos and blogs at barkleypd.com.